This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. What's the second act for a used-up Hong Kong stuntman living in Hollywood? For Louis Mo, the unsung hero of a slew of kung fu movies, it's a job as a petty criminal, using his skills to steal valuable memorabilia or rough up a guy who's not paying his debts on time. When unsavory types who don't want to get their Armani suits dirty say, "I got a guy," that guy is Louis Mo. But when he's asked to intimidate an up-and-coming film producer who's not delivering on his latest project, and the producer recognizes Louis, he suddenly finds himself starring in his very own action movie. Only in Hollywood? Well, and in the pages of the new crime novel Dog Beach by Vermonter John Fusco. This guy, John Fusco, doesn't seem to ever slow down. He's written a couple of novels now, a children's book about kung fu teachings, and he's behind a number of blockbuster films, including Young Guns, Hidalgo, and Spirit, Stallion of the Cimarron. And to top it all off, he's got a new series coming out on Netflix about legendary Venetian merchant Marco Polo, whose detailed accounts of his experiences in Asia inspired other explorers like Christopher Columbus. Today on Vermont Edition, we will try to keep up as we chat with John Fusco. John, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me. Good to see you again.
I know that you inquired about VPR's coffee before you even got to the studio. So is that what keeps you going?
No, you know, it's a little bit of coffee and a little bit of that early morning creative adrenaline. That's the magic mix, I call it. It's like a surfer catching the wave right at that right time. But because I'm still not quite over jet lag from all the travels, I'm having a little later coffee this morning, too.
Let's talk a little bit about your novel, Dog Beach. I really enjoyed reading it.
Thank you.
You're doing the book tour thing right now. You're giving readings. You're doing signings, even as you work a little bit more on this Netflix series and other projects. What inspired you in the midst of all this other work to write a Hollywood crime novel?
You know, it was a confluence of three things. And it was shortly after the 2007 writer's strike. It was a historic writer's strike that lasted a really long time, about a year. And there was a certain attitude coming out of Hollywood at that point in time that writers might be becoming obsolete, and that that Hollywood could exist on pre-branded material and video games and comic books and graphic novels and that type of thing. So I'd been making observations about this period in Hollywood. At the same time, I had been working with a lot of Hong Kong stuntmen in China on my film, The Forbidden Kingdom. And I had been training with the stuntmen, traveling with them, and learning a lot about this fascinating subculture of the Hong Kong stuntmen. The third piece was a memory that I've had for a long time that's been haunting me and teasing me, and that was back early in my career, a former NYU classmate followed me out to L.A. and invited me to his palatial Malibu house, and which took me by surprise. I was like, man, okay, you made it very quickly. How'd you do that? And he said, well, I optioned a screenplay idea to a producer, and he's going to let me live in this beach house for 1 year, and I have 1 year to turn this script in. And so I went to visit him at this house, and there were other film school grads living there from UCLA and USC, and they all had their different projects. And it occurred to me that they were more like hostages than tenants living in this situation. And so I always felt, you know what, there's something in there. And sometimes, you know, individual ideas won't fire the spark plug for a full-blown story, but if you add the different ideas into the pot, into the sauce, as it were, it can come together into one rich idea. And that's what happened with Dog Beach. So it was a combination of what was going on in Hollywood at the time post-strike, the world of the Hong Kong stuntmen, and the world of these thresholder film school grads living in Malibu.
Did you steal their name for their Malibu palatial house, which, you know, in the book, these guys, these young guys call it the dog house because they're on Dog Beach?
It actually came from Dog Beach in Malibu, where I once lived. And the dog house was my creation, and they call themselves the Dogs of Entropy. And that's their sort of band apart posse, young filmmaker entrepreneurs.
Louis Mo, the arguably the main character in the book, really, is very well developed. I mean, you feel like you know Louis Moe just by watching behind as he walks up the stairs to his room. It can take him 20 minutes to climb a flight of stairs right. to get to his bedroom at night, and he pops pills like, you know, they're M&Ms. But you get this guy in front of a camera, and he's rolling over cars, and he's throwing punches, and he's chasing bad guys and running out in front of explosions. And he's got this adrenaline, you know, mm-hmm. the cortisol kick that
yes,
is
yeah.
so important to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know guys like that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I've been fortunate. The kind of work that I do, the stories that I write, have allowed me to work with some of the stunt legends. Going back to, well, years back during Young Guns, we had an older stunt coordinator named Everett Creech. And Everett was actually John Wayne's stunt double back in his younger days. And I worked with Mickey Gilbert, who was the stuntman who doubled for Robert Redford when he jumped off the cliff holding hands with Paul Newman in Butch and Sundance. And then onward into the world of the Kung Fu and Hong Kong stuntmen. The Hong Kong stuntman is a really special breed. A lot of them came out of the Peking Opera School, which might sound strange, but this opera school was really about movement and acrobatics and theater and martial arts performance. So a lot of these guys came out, they were known as the Red Trousers, and went into the stunt world. So I had the opportunity to train with them, to have the benefit of their amazing performances in my movies, and to go out and get to know them and hear the stories about their history, a lot of the stuff that they had to deal with. But yeah, there is that thing. And one of the guys, you mentioned this cortisol, he referred to it as the cortisol speedball, and which would just would drive him. And it was, if he was down, if he was in between jobs, it was like he needed to go to work. He needed that next big stunt. And so, yeah, those guys are out there, and they inspired Louis Moe, who's really a composite of many different Hong Kong stuntmen.
We're talking today with author, screenwriter, and martial artist John Fusco about movie stunts, kung fu practice, and we'll be talking as well about Marco Polo and about how he balances a life in Vermont with adventures in Hollywood and Asia. If you have a question about how working with Netflix is opening up new avenues to filmmakers and screenwriters, or if you want to know about what it's like to see Marco Polo's last will and testament, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your questions for John Fusco on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Have you ever done any stunt work yourself?
You know, back during Young Guns, because I'm a horseman, I actually doubled Lou Diamond Phillips for a stunt.
Really?
Which I wasn't supposed to talk about at the time for insurance purposes, but it's been long enough. I had long hair at that point in time. I was very close with the Wranglers. And I remembered that one of the Wranglers just went over and said, "Hey, John, you get on that horse and you do it." And I got up with the stunt guys and did a full speed, full gallop out across the prairie. I was tempted to during Marco Polo. I worked closely with the martial arts choreographers, and they were always trying to get me to go in. There's a lot of kung fu that I wrote into the script that relates to a system that I practice. And so I was often demonstrating that for some of the stuntmen who did not know that style. But other than going full out on horseback and Young Guns, no, I haven't done any more since then.
Although you were a stand-in for Jackie Chan at one point, just when you were blocking out scenes.
That's true, yes, on horseback. We were blocking out a scene with Jackie and several other actors who were riding through the bamboo forest on horses. And they didn't have a stand-in who could ride a horse, was actually afraid to get on the horse. And so the Wrangler who knew me had me hop on. So, yeah, I guess that's two.
Yeah. At the end of the book, you dedicate the whole novel to the memory of a friend of yours who was a stuntman. Can you tell us about him?
Oh, yeah. Ju Kun, just a real, I mean, a treasure in the world of martial arts as a practitioner. Legendary stuntman, and although he was quite young, his accomplishments, his dossier is just phenomenal. Most recently, he did major stunts in The Grandmaster, which has really raised the bar on martial arts cinema. And he came on to Marco Polo to work as the assistant stunt coordinator and martial arts choreographer. I had worked with him on The Forbidden Kingdom. He was Jet Li's stunt double. That's how good he is. And I was training regularly during the prep phase every morning with the stuntmen. So I was working out a lot with Ju Kun. On this past March 7th, we trained together, and I was heading to my office to start the day. And I looked over and I saw him standing there by the dojo, our portable stunt dojo. And I remember looking at him and thinking, God, this guy is just such an amazing treasure of martial arts knowledge. And I wanted to get a photo with him and send it to our mutual friend Jet Li and let him know we're working together again. So we went over, we posed for a photo, took it. The next morning, March 8th, he had gotten onto a flight to Beijing from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, to go visit his two young boys for the weekend. And that plane was never found. That was Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. So we lost Ju Kun on that flight. And it was a devastating event for the entire Marco Polo production, the stunt team. But that stunt team, which I mean, was made up of a lot of young Chinese stuntmen under Ju Kun, they all had to either leave, which was they considered doing, it was so devastating, or pull together and step up and fill his shoes. They chose the latter, and that inspired the entire production, and this Marco Polo show came together like a real family.
And you see his work still in Marco Polo, even though he wasn't there for most of the production?
Yes, you know, because we began prep so early, and so he was there for months before working on the choreography. And so a lot of the fight sequences that you will see in Marco Polo, he was very much involved with his very elegant, poetic, dance-like style of Shaolin, Kung Fu, and Wushu.
That must have been a very personal loss and personal attachment to what became a real fascination for people around the world. And I'm sorry for your loss.
Oh, thank you. Thanks, Jane. Yeah.
In the book, on the blurbs, this we're talking about here, Dog Beach, you know, right on the back, in two of the blurbs, you are compared favorably to Elmore Leonard. And Elmore Leonard, of course, is known for his crime fiction, but he also got started as a writer of Westerns.
That's right.
And you share a love of Western, mm-hmm. Western work, Western movies, similar themes for the two of you. Do you feel a connection to Elmore Leonard?
You know, I mean, it's... I'm really flattered and honored by the references because Elmore Leonard is, I mean, he's the king and master when it comes to this type of hard-boiled fiction. And interestingly enough, I have not read a lot of his crime fiction, but I have read a lot of his Westerns. And I was always a fan and an admirer. Elmore Leonard has... an interesting, lean, crisp style, which I think every screenwriter can benefit from studying because he just hacks away at the unessentials. And that style really comes from my screenwriting and not so much from studying or being influenced by Elmore Leonard.
You and Elmore Leonard diverge in your interests, though, when it comes to martial arts. I don't know of any martial arts stuff in Elmore Leonard's work, I'm not an expert either. You grew up in Connecticut. You spent a lot of time in your youth traveling down south. You went to film school. Where did your love of martial arts start?
My father was a Korean War vet, and when I was a very young boy, he used to entertain me with stories about Korea. And one of my favorites, and I was always asking him to tell me and retell me and demonstrate, was learning Tangsudo Mudokwan, our secret fighting techniques, Korean fighting techniques, from an elder, a Korean elder, who he had become very close to. And I would say, Dad, show me this move, show me this technique. And one day he said, you know, are you really serious about this? And I told him I was. And he got on the phone and he called a former veteran friend who owned a dojang, or a Korean martial arts school, in the area. And he said, can you get this kid in? He's driving me crazy with, you know, his karate love. And he said, yeah, bring him down. And so I started studying Korean martial arts at 12 years old. This was just before the Bruce Lee explosion around the world, and just before the 1970s television series Kung Fu with David Carradine became so popular. And that only fueled my interest. And so that's where it all started.
And what about now? Can you talk a little bit about your practice?
Yes. I had gotten away from martial arts for a while, but always the philosophy stayed with me, the love for it. There are deeper precepts and principles to it that have really informed my life. I never let go of those. I always felt I would one day get back to practice. But what I had always truly been interested in was the Chinese system, the Chinese styles of martial arts, which were almost impossible to find where I was. There was a lot of, you know, there were a lot of Korean and Japanese styles, but I loved Shaolin Kung Fu. Back when I moved to Vermont, I learned fortuitously that there was a Shaolin Kung Fu practitioner, a master, who had a school in Vermont, the Vermont Kung Fu Academy, and taught not only Qigong and Chinese healing arts. He was an acupuncturist. He was also a master of Northern Shaolin praying mantis Kung Fu. So I started studying with Sifu Arthur Macaris at the Vermont Kung Fu Academy in 1999 and returned to martial arts full speed ahead and have not stopped since. It came back to me at a great time in my life. I also study Wing Chun and Jeet Kune Do, and because I travel so much, wherever I go, I like to seek out local martial artists, learn new styles, incorporate them into my practice.
How do you work with people for whom this is part of their cultural heritage, in addition to being something that they know as a skill, whether it's in the movies or elsewhere? You know, you're a white guy from Connecticut. So mm-hmm. how do you, and you do a lot of traveling and a lot of world traveling, and you've worked with Native Americans in the West, and you've worked with a lot of Kung Fu practitioners in the East. So how do you deal with that sort of cultural melding?
You know, it's interesting because it's an idea that's always fascinated me. And as you were describing it, I'm thinking, that kind of runs through most of my movies and the stories that I've written, and you know, Thunderheart or Crossroads, which my very first film was, you know, about a young white Juilliard music student who seeks out a long-lost Delta blues legend, an old black man, and travels with him into the South. And I've always been fascinated by that idea because I feel that if you have a true and earnest love for something, a treasure from a culture, if you're sincere about it, and you really seek it out and seek out the elders and the teachers, and they learn that you truly care about it and want to learn it in the traditional, respectful way, they're very responsive and very open. Of course, I mean, it takes some breaking through. There are some who just want nothing to do with it. There are some who will find it very amusing. But in my experience, in the case of learning new Kung Fu styles in the park, if I keep showing up every morning at 5 a.m., they're like, okay, there's the guy who won't go away. I don't see anyone else standing out here in the snow. I'm going to teach him.
When it comes then to writing a screenplay that includes Kung Fu or martial arts, I imagine it must help really a lot to be able to know what you're talking about. I mean, do screenwriters who are writing a movie that includes a lot of martial arts work, if they don't have the skills themselves, can the actors feel it?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think what usually happens, and the way that I found that out, was I was in China sitting across the table from Master Yuan Wuping, who is the most legendary martial arts choreographer and action director in the world. He's considered the grandfather of the genre. He really created the Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon style. that poetic, airborne, balletic style. That's Master Wu Ping. And so he's Sifu to everyone, master to all in that genre and that Hong Kong cinema world. So when he signed on to do the action direction for The Forbidden Kingdom, we sat at a table and he went through the pages and his translator read the fight scenes as I wrote them. And I write them in great detail. I write in techniques. I write in shifts in the systems. I write in metrical beats and breaks and strikes on the half measure. I kind of do it like choreographing a dance on the page. But I try to make it very readable. I mean, most people who read it say, and I think you see this in Dog Beach, when Louis Mo fights, I'm describing that fight in real time, every punch, every move. And it should be exciting and very readable. But when a martial artist reads it, he should also say, oh, yeah, I get the practical application. I know what he's doing. This is real world stuff. This is not Hong Kong phooey, as an old teacher of mine used to call a lot of martial arts movies. Well, one of my fight scenes was read to Master Wu Ping, and he just looked across the table at me, chewing a toothpick for a long, silent moment. And I was thinking, uh-oh. You know, and it was like choreographing a dance scene on the page for Fred Astaire, you know. And he said something in Cantonese, and his translator said, you know, the master says most writers just write, and now they fight.
Right.
And they leave it to him. And I said, well, you know, master, this is just a jumping off point. I just get into it when I write. And he said, no, the stunt boys told me you've been working out down at the stunt tent and that you do old style Shaolin Kung Fu. And I said, yeah, I practice. And he said, you were doing praying mantis, Tang Long Chuan. I said, yes. And he said, interesting. I like these ideas. I like this. We're going to try some of this. And so that kicked off a collaboration between Master Wu Ping and myself. And it was so exciting because I would go down to the stunt tent and watch what he did with one of my scenes. And he would look at me and I remember he'd say, okay. I said, yeah, that's great. I love where you took that and kind of added a little comedy into it. And I love that pause. But essentially, he stuck to the template and to the ideas. And now we're working again together on the sequel to Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. I wrote the script, and he is the director, not just the action director. He's at the helm. And so we have a shorthand now, and it's a real honor and privilege that we're able to work together in that way. And I learn every day from him.
We're talking with John Fusco today. More to come with him. And if you have a question about martial arts, if you want to talk about kung fu in the movies, how you write this kind of movie, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit about his 10-episode series, Marco Polo, which premieres on Netflix in December. What it's like to work in this kind of realm in the new era of TV series where they all come out at once on Netflix. We'll talk about that. More with John Fusco coming up. You can send your questions to the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, I'm speaking with Vermont filmmaker and author John Fusco. He's got a new series coming out in December on Netflix called Marco Polo. And Dog Beach, his latest novel, explores the dark side of Hollywood. If you have a question for him, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. That series, Marco Polo, coming out on Netflix, I mean, this is the new wave when it comes to TV work. You get them all out at once. That's sort of ability for people to binge watch a series. And it's obviously longer than if you're doing a feature film. Why did you want to work in that genre?
You know, it's a great question, Jane. And I think that a lot of the stuff that I explore in the novel Dog Beach, or some might say Lampoon, is the kind of stuff that has driven a lot of Hollywood writers and directors to television as it exists today. And it's ironic because through most of my career, writing for the small screen, as it were, was something a features writer did if he couldn't get work in Hollywood on the big screen. it's completely flipped now. And the we are really in the second golden age of television. You know, the first was in the 50s. But right now, because so many writers and directors like the Spielbergs and Scorseses are heading to television, we are seeing the most exciting creative work that's out there. This new long-form type of series like House of Cards, Orange is the New Black, Game of Thrones, it's like really the new great American novel. The quality is that high. As a writer or a show creator, it really is like your novel. You're creating chapters and it lives on. And if you're fortunate, you go to future seasons. The networks, you know, like Netflix, are pushing the proverbial envelope in so many ways and risk-taking. So it was a real draw for me to look and say, okay, this is where it's happening. This is where you want to be right now creatively.
And do you – I mean, you were talking about some of the series that have become so popular, House of Cards, Game of Thrones, that kind of thing. Does it take – Netflix pushing something like this forward to get it into the viewpoint of all of the viewers who might get it? Because things can also get lost when it's just out there somewhere for people to find. You know, the network TV, it was, this is what is on television, this is what you'll be watching. Netflix or an online series, people have a million possibilities. So does it just take that behemoth behind it saying, no, this is our next big thing, and is Marco Polo getting that kind of push?
Well, I mean, yes, absolutely. And I think that original Netflix programming has become so popular. I mean, just so many Emmy nominations this year. Shows like House of Cards and Orange is the New Black are calling cards for Marco Polo, because that's, you know, we are Netflix's next big original series that's coming out. There's already buzz and word of mouth. Viewers are drawn to this streaming type of show where you can get your vat of guacamole and hole up and you can watch as many episodes as you want. I didn't quite understand that. And I was like, I could never do that. But then the first time I sat back to watch Orange is the New Black and get a sense of Netflix, four episodes later, I was saying, I think I can watch another one.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't stay up late, but those kind of shows can be very addictive. And it's like reading a novel. It's like one more chapter.
You've kind of ruined guacamole for me. I just have to say, a vat of guacamole does not sound appealing. And
well, when you have 10 episodes, it requires a tub. Yeah.
What about the subject matter? Why Marco Polo?
I've been passionate about Marco Polo for quite a while, because for as long as my interest in China, you know, which really started back in that period when I was first interested in martial arts. And you cannot read about the history of China without coming across the name Marco Polo. I was fascinated by the fact that he was of Italian ancestry, because I am, and that he had this unlikely love and attraction to the East and to that culture. But it wasn't until 2007, when I was in China shooting The Forbidden Kingdom, my son, who was 13 then, called me. And he said, you know, we've been talking about doing a Mongolian horseback trek since I was 8 years old, and you've always promised me we would. Because my son was and still is something of a Mongolist and has always had a fascination with Genghis Khan and the Mongol Empire and Mongolia. And he said, I'm looking at the map. You're in Beijing. You are a one-hour flight from Ulaanbaatar, the capital of Mongolia. Let's do it. Let's go do the trip. And I said, well, you know, I'm shooting a movie. He's like, yeah, okay. And I was like, no, I'm not going to let this go away. This is our opportunity. He's right. And so I, through my contacts on the set, on the movie set, I found a guide up in Mongolia who specialized in taking journalists you know, unconventional travelers up into far-flung regions of Mongolia to look for shaman or to go up into the taiga forest. And I knew that's what my son wanted. He did not want, you know, your National Geographic tour with a bunch of people. So I sought out this guide. I told him what we were looking for, and that was it. I booked the time, and my son flew to China, and we traveled to Mongolia. and met our guide. And then we traveled in a Russian utility van way out, 8 hours out into central Mongolia, and stayed at a ger camp, or, you know, more commonly known as yurt, which was the Turkish, ger is Mongolian. But we lived in gers and waited for our horses to arrive. And then we traveled on horseback with our guide, a Mongolian nomad, and half-broken Mongolian horses, and rode across part of central Mongolia together. And it was out during that trip, riding with my son, again, the name Marco Polo kept coming up because our guide was a real Mongolian historian. In fact, I would later hire him onto Marco Polo as our cultural advisor, my good friend Biamba. Biamba and my son Gio would have these great long conversations about Mongolian history, and the name Marco Polo kept coming up. And I'm there on my horse riding along through these amazing Mongolian vistas, and I felt, you know what? Marco Polo. This is the time to do it. And at the same time, I had been getting calls about this second golden age of television, and calls were coming in saying, hey, you've got the Forbidden Kingdom with a Westerner in China. Do you have anything that can translate to this long form of TV? And I said, I've absolutely got it. When I get home, I'll tell you. And I worked on a pitch. I went back into the Marco Polo history, and I was so excited about it and said, this is perfect for this type of show. And no one really knows anything about Marco Polo. I would learn later in Venice that most people have not even a clue, which is just shocking, but also attractive to a writer because it feels like untapped territory. I pitched the idea to a few producer friends, and they felt, I don't know, that's history. Maybe we're thinking of something more contemporary. But a few months later, I got a call from Harvey Weinstein, arguably the most powerful man in Hollywood, and the guy who's always there standing with the Best Picture Oscar at the end of the night. And Harvey called me and he said, I've got several people on the phone with me, several creative executives, and I told them that I'm going to say a name and that you would know everything about that name. Don't let me down. And I said, go for it, Harvey. And he said, Marco Polo. And I kind of laughed and said, you know, Harvey, it doesn't surprise me because you and I both have a mutual love for Chinese cinema. And I think we both have a sense that this could be an amazing show right now, and very timely. So I pitched my Marco Polo series idea to him, and the very next day I was on the phone with the network pitching, and we were off to the races.
And now here we are.
Here
December 12th comes out at midnight.
December 12th, midnight.
Mm-hmm. John, you were talking about your son saying, Dad, we got to do this. I really want to do this. I really want to do this. When you and I started talking, you mentioned that it was when you were about the same age, and you said to your dad, no, I'm really serious about martial arts. Mm-hmm. I really want to do this. And your dad said, okay, I'll make it happen.
Yeah.
Does that influence your parenting style?
It does. It really does. I mean, I think that when a child expresses an interest in something, we really have to look at that and nurture that and sort of create those opportunities to see where it's going. Because I believe in looking at my writing, everything traces back to this well that I draw from even today, but it's a well that started filling up in childhood with these different interests. Martial arts, the American West, Native American culture. It's these loves and passions start at a young age. And I believe that it's important to get young people to connect with those loves.
All of the stuff we've been talking about is a far cry from a quiet life in Vermont. Why do you even live here? I mean, that sounds so aggressive, but I mean, you've got all of these other interests in other places. What draws you back to Vermont?
You know, it's my favorite state in the country. And growing up in Connecticut, I grew up in a fairly rural area. But my father had a cabin on the Tweed River in Stockbridge, Vermont, in the southern part of the state, where he liked to take us up and fish. And so whenever we would travel there, and I grew up as a nature lover and young outdoorsman, but as we would drive farther north and get deeper into Vermont, it just felt like, wow, the wildlife is bigger. The forest communities are more rich. And I loved the mountains. I loved the people. I loved the Vermont ethos. And so it stuck with me. And after spending time in New York and Los Angeles, both my wife and I, and my wife grew up with a similar background in Connecticut, and her father was a small-scale dairy farmer, so he traveled to Vermont quite a bit too. When we talked about leaving LA and New York and going back home, we both zeroed in on Vermont as the place where we'd like to live and raise a family.
Well, lucky us. John Fusco, thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you so much, Jane.
John will be giving a reading from his new novel, Dog Beach, at Barnes & Noble in South Burlington at 2 p.m. this Saturday. And his 10-episode series, Marco Polo, premieres on Netflix at midnight on December 12th. Coming up, Vermont's role in the War of 1812. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Scuba divers who brave the cold depths of Lake Champlain may not encounter tropical fish, but they do have the chance to see something arguably more dazzling, shipwrecks dating back to the War of 1812. On dry land, there are few visible reminders of this war in Vermont, but they do exist. Battery Park in Burlington is the most prominent example. This week, archaeologists in Vermont are trying to draw our attention back to the War of 1812. They're holding a conference on Friday that examines the role of our region in that war. Jess Robinson is the Vermont State Archaeologist, and he joins me now. Jess, nice to talk with you.
Thanks very much, Jane.
Okay, so the War of 1812 actually lasted to 1814.
Yeah, actually slightly into 1815, because the treaty was signed in 1814, but it took a little while for the message to get back into the South, actually.
So that's why we're talking about it now. We're in 2014.
Yeah.
Still got a little bit of time.
Exactly. And actually, you know, when we talk about when the war came to the Champlain Valley, that was actually more in 1814. And so this is actually the bicentennial year of the Battle of Plattsburgh, one of the big battles of the War of 1812, really turned the tide of the war, at least from the American perspective. And so we're celebrating that.
Well, starting there, since you've mentioned that, I mean, can you give us, I mean, really the thumbnail version for people who may not be quite up on their war history?
Sure. And I have to say I'm an archaeologist and not a military historian. And so there's certainly colleagues that are more familiar with the intricacies of this than I, but basically, and what this conference will highlight is that the war proceeded sort of northward. It was on three fronts: the Great Lakes, the St. Lawrence River, and Champlain being sort of one of those fronts. And as the war proceeded through time, Lake Champlain became to be seen as more and more strategic. And as Eric Tishnick is going to highlight on Friday, he terms this a war of broad axes. And that before the final Battle of Plattsburgh actually took place, there was a very much a push to build the biggest, the most effective ships on the lake for the perceived naval battle that was to come.
And remind us what we were fighting for.
It's funny because every side in this conflict has different views. For the British, it was part of the Napoleonic Wars and was just seen as one front on that. And the Canadians view this as very much a war of territorial integrity and really bolstered their perception of themselves as a young fledgling nation. Then British America, but eventually become Canada. In the U.S., it was a fight right up until really the Battle of Plattsburgh, which turned the tide and allowed us to keep our territorial integrity. People forget that this was the time, only time that the capital was invaded and burned. It was very much a fight for survival and took a radical toll on life and in infrastructure. And the fact that we sort of came through the fire, if you will, really sort of unified America in a way for a while after. It just so happens that the Revolutionary War before it and the Civil War after it were such prominent events in American history that the War of 1812 has sort of been forgotten forgotten or less emphasized in history books. And therefore, archaeology has a part to play in sort of revitalizing our knowledge on the ground, if you will, about these important events.
Well, tell us about that and how the Battle of Plattsburgh plays into how archaeologists in this region are really bringing up the profile of this war.
Well, sure. Well, it's a good emblem, if you will, the Battle of Plattsburgh, because it's the bicentennial. But it gives us a view into some sort of more random events coalesced. The Lake Champlain Maritime Museum with Eric Tichnook and Chris Sabick, among others, have really been doing some great work systematically over the last number of years, documenting the shipwrecks from this battle and from other engagements in Lake Champlain. And as they would attest, Lake Champlain is probably unparalleled in its sort of for its number of underwater shipwrecks and their preservation because of the conditions. And I've never been scuba diving before, so I have to take their word for it, but I trust them implicitly. Much more serendipitously or randomly, if you will, a few years ago on North Street in Burlington, there was a revitalization project going on, and this involved laying a lot of new utility lines and updating them. And in that process, they came across the remains of burials, which were quickly determined to be those of the War of 1812 soldiers, which was sort of a revelation. And then work by my colleagues, John Kroc, the director at the Consulting Archaeology Program at UVM, and Kate Kenny, the historian there, really uncovered the massive scale of the cemetery there and the sort of cantonment there and the hospital and the caring for the sick. So we have the battle side, this major battle with the War of with the Battle of Lake Champlain, also known as the Battle of Plattsburgh, and then the civilian sort of off the battle side at the Burlington cantonment and the daily life during war, and really this forgotten battlefield that's just starting to be reawakened in our sort of minds and our thoughts and what to do going on in the future.
That cantonment that you mentioned, you know, is in the middle of development in Burlington. So it's not like we're going to raise all the buildings.
No. And obviously that's not a part of it. It quite quickly after the War of 1812, by the 20s and 30s, Kate Kenny has documented that people were sort of almost forgetting that it was there, the 1820s and 30s, saying, oh, I go and pick blueberries there and I think there's some burials over there. And then it became a military parade ground and then a fairgrounds and then finally was sold to developers and began building up in what's now the north end of Burlington, the old north end. And but there's estimated to be between 600 and 700 burials in that region, many of which have obviously are now gone due to modern development. But from what UVM has uncovered is many are remarkably well preserved with, you know, a gas line going on one side of them and an electric line going right on the other side of them. And they just happen to be preserved. And so there's probably many still in yards and under the sidewalk. And so it's something that, you know, there's no firm consensus right now on what to do, but it's something that at least archaeologists, the city of Burlington, and we at the state are aware of and are trying to come up with some sort of protocols with as time goes on.
So you're working on this to figure out what to do now with the fact that you have this burial ground underneath one of the most developed residential parts of Burlington.
Yeah. I mean, I came into this job very recently, only about a month ago, and Giovanna Peebles, my predecessor, who was at the job for 38 years, was very much a part of this. So like many things, I'm just getting up to speed. But I worked for UVM in their consulting archaeology program before taking this job, as well as in the anthropology department as an adjunct professor. So I actually know about this from both sides of it. And it's just going to take some time to come to a consensus and come to some understanding of a practical solution. And we're exploring all sorts of options, ground penetrating radar and other things. And so that should be coming along.
I also mentioned Battery Park. Can you just quickly tell us why Battery Park was important?
Yeah, well, it was part of this or adjacent to this larger cantonment. And it did have sort of a defensive posture. It had cannons. It had some earthworks. And it was the subject of entitled Murray's Raid. It was a brief bout of cannon fire up onto the battery and then back out onto naval vessels. Quite brief, but reports even throughout the 1800s would say like, oh, I found a cannonball in my front yard. I wonder where that was from. And it was from this brief encounter, this military encounter, direct military encounter. But In all other instances, Burlington was very much a place of refuge. It had a hospital, and at one point up to 4,000 people were housed there simultaneously. At its worst point, many some from direct warfare casualties, but many from disease, influenza, tuberculosis. And that is likely one of the reasons why the cemetery got to be so large and probably why they weren't marked as well as they could have been. It was very much, in the worst parts of the war anyway, triage conditions, many people dying from sickness quite rapidly and being disposed of as sort of as soon as they could.
Well, thank you so much, Jess, for giving us this view of history and bringing it to life for us. I really appreciate you telling us about it.
Sure. Thanks for having me. And I would love to have people come out Friday to the Contois Auditorium in Burlington.
Yeah. Jess Robinson is the Vermont State Archaeologist. He's been telling us a little bit about the War of 1812 in Vermont and that conference on Friday in Burlington that will explore the topic in depth. We'll put a link up at vpr.net. That'll do it for today's show. Tomorrow on the program, an update on issues facing the Department for Children and Families. The new commissioner, Ken Schatz, joins me to discuss protocols on child abuse investigations and the aftermath of two deaths of toddlers who were under DCF supervision. That's tomorrow on Vermont Edition, and you can send your questions to vermontedition@vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.